Okay, we're on Parshas Shlach. Parshas Shlach, page 798. As we always do, we'll just start with a bit of a review. Overview, I should say, on the Parsha. So, of course, this Parsha starts off with the famous story of sending the spies, which turned out badly. Because we have them coming back, and the second part is the negative report that they give and the punishment that they receive of having to remain in the desert for 40 years. We then have the story of the Ma'apilim. The Ma'apilim were people that understood that God was angry for them not wanting to go into the land of Israel. So after the whole ordeal was over, they said, we're going to try and go. And they started to move up the mountain and towards Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, don't try. God has decided that he's going to punish you and keep you here in the desert. And therefore, v'hi lo sitzlach, it won't be successful. And you will end up being punished, which is actually what happened. So it was unsuccessful, the venture. The fourth thing is, after the whole story of the spies, we have the mitzvah of the nesach and the mitzvah of the libations on the altar, which means when they were told that when they go to Eretz Yisrael, they're going to bring sacrifices, which we've had a lot about sacrifices in Vayikra. The Torah says that every sacrifice has to be accompanied with a pouring of the wine or water on the mizbech down the pipe of the altar. Then, of course, famously, we have this parasha. We have the mitzvah of challah, the mitzvah of separating challah, right? Which is, of course, an important mitzvah and one of the mitzvahs that comes in this week's parasha. We then have a section which deals with inadvertent idolatry. What happens if people, either individuals or communities, serve idolatry inadvertently? There's a whole process of sacrifices that they have to bring to achieve atonement. Then after that, we have the story of the Mekoshesh. The Mekoshesh was a person who broke Shabbos very soon after Shabbos was given, and described what happened to him. And then finally, we have at the end of the parasha, we have the mitzvah of tzitzis, the mitzvah of males putting a tzitzis on a four-cornered garment. If they wear a four-cornered garment, they have to wear tzitzis. That's the synopsis of the parasha. But essentially, the beginning of the parasha is parasha Shlach. I want to just learn the story of the Meraglim. I want to just learn a little bit of the parasha inside, and we'll go into some aspects which a bit more detail than we've done in the previous years. So let's have a look again, page 798. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Lamer, and Hashem spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu saying, Shlach lecha anashim, send for yourself men, v'yosuru as Eretz Kanan, and they will spy is one translation, but v'yosuru could also mean to explore, to investigate the land of Kanan, asher ani noisein livnei Yisrael, that I'm going to be giving to the Jewish people. Ish echad, ish echad. One man, one man. Lemate avoiso, according to the tribes of their fathers. Tishlochu, you shall send. Kol nasi bohem. Everyone, the leader of that particular tribe, should go. Vayishlach oiso Moshe. And Moshe sent them. They meet by Paran, from the desert of Paran. That's where they were. That's where they were living. Al pi Hashem, by the word of Hashem. Kulam anoshim, they were all men of stature. Roshei b'nei Yisrael heima, they were heads of the Jewish people. Right. And Rashi makes a point that when the pasuk says kulam anoshim, they were all men of stature. It means to say they were tzaddikim. Rashi makes the point that at that time. I forgot. I actually copied it. Have a look at the second Rashi on the handout. Right? Rashi says, Kulam Anoshim, they were all men. Says Rashi, Kol Anoshim Shebemikra, anytime that uses the word Anoshim, men, the word for men, Anoshim in the Pasuk, Lashon Chashivus, it's an expression of prominence. And the reason for that is, the Oysa Shah at that time, Ksheirim Hoyu, they were kosher. They were, that's the thing. When they went, when they left, they were okay. We'll see what that means in a minute. Okay, so they go, and he goes and enumerates all of the tribes. Let's just skip a little bit, because what happens is we see Have a look at Pasuk Tesayin, Pasuk 16, right, verse 15. It says, after it lists all the 12 tribes, it says, Eile Shmoisa Nashim, these are the names of the men. Asher Shalach Moshe Lasuras Ores, that Moshe Rabbeinu sent to investigate the land. Vayikra Moshe Lahoshea bin Nun Yehoshua. And Moshe Rabbeinu called Hoshea, which was his private student, but he was also the leader of Ephraim, he called him Yehoshua. So he changed his name to Yehoshua. The reason for that is, because as Rashi says, that it was to add, to make his name into the name of God. So Hoshea became Yehoshua, which means the Yud and the Hay. And the word Hoshea means to save, as if it was a prayer that God should save you from the evil plan, or from the plan of the Meraglim. He should save you from that, and he should protect you. We'll see why Moshe Rabbeinu singled out Yehoshua to do that. It seems like favoritism, but we'll see that a little bit later. And the end of the story is that Yehoshua survives the ordeal. Yehoshua comes back, and he's one of the only two of the 12 people that actually gave a positive report and encouraged the Jewish people to have faith and to believe in the process that could actually, in fact, go into Eretz Yisrael and conquer it. The other one we know was Kolev. Kolev, who was the leader of the tribe of Yehuda. Right? Now, he didn't get his name changed by Moshe Rabbeinu, but he managed to survive. He had a different plan. Let's have a look what it is. If you turn over the page, and it's just something I'm going to digress a little bit and go into, because it's a fascinating concept which comes up in this parsha. So if you turn to the page, Pasuk Chavbeis, verse 22. Right? It says that they went to Eretz Yisrael and they were touring the land. It says, Vayalu Banegev. They went up in the south. Right? So that's where they travel. They travel southwards. Vayovoi ad Chevron, and he came to Chevron. Which contextually would mean they came to Chevron. Right? But we'll see what that means in a second. Vashom Achimai Sheishai V'talmei Yilidei Ha'anok. And in Hebron there were four people called the giants, the men of giants. Achiman Sheshav Talmud. The Hebron Shemashom Nimisolat Netzoyim Mitzrayim. And Hebron was built 7 years before Tzoyim Mitzrayim, which I'm not going to go into now. Rashi goes into the whole thing why the Pasuk needs to say that. Okay. So the Pasuk says they went southward, but then it says he came to Hebron. So let's have a look at the Rashi. First Rashi that I copied on your handout. It's easier to follow. It says Rashi, Vayovoi ad Hebron, he came to Hebron. Kolev levadoi holach sham. Only Kolev went to Hebron. That's why it says he went to Hebron. Why did he go there? He went to daven at the graves of our forefathers. V'nishtateach al kibre ovois. He went to prostrate himself, to give himself over, to daven on the forefathers of the graves of the forefathers. Shelo yohanissas lachaveri. We shouldn't attach himself to his friends. Liyois paatzosam, to be part of their plan. So he needed an extra strength. So he went to daven at the caver of Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov and Sarif Baruch Aleya that he should be protected from joining with his friends, and that's how he managed to get out of the whole thing, and that's the thing. Now, I'm going to come back to the whole story of the Meraglim, but I don't think I've ever done this in this parsha, but in this parsha, a lot of Mepharshim talk about this whole concept of davening at a graveside of a tzaddik. Interestingly enough, I bring this up because of late, and I think it's particularly post-fall of communism, I think that's probably fair to say, it's become, and where we're now free, people are able to travel freely back to Russia and Poland, where people are making trips to discover their roots, and so all these kind of things, right? One of the things that's become increasingly popular, and I say it's increasingly popular, it's interesting because it used to be a very Hasidic thing, now it's become very universal, that people travel to Kivrei Tzadikim, they travel to the graves of Tzadikim. I mean, there's a thing, for example, like I think it's in the month of Adar, if I'm not mistaken. I just read, because I see the papers come out of Israel, where now there's on the yard site of Rebbe Elimelech of Lizhensk, who was a tremendous great Rebbe and a tzaddik and so on. There's this huge charter trip that people make from Israel and tours, and all the people go and daven at his kever on his yard site. Uman is a very interesting one. Uman is the Breslover Rebbe's caver, who apparently had said that if people come to his caver in Rosh Hashanah time, it will be very, very good for them. And of course, during communism, during the time when it was all tied, it was very, very limited. But now it just exploded. I mean, every Rosh Hashanah, there must be, they say, there's thousands and thousands of people there. breast livers, not breast livers, all kinds of interesting people go there for, you know. Although, I mean, in Eretz Yisrael, of course, I mean, if you go to Meron, and like Ba'omer, it's just packed. Or you go to, any time you go to Meron, there's always a crowd there. You go to the Tzfas, by the Rizal's Kever, there's always people there. So it's become a very, very fashionable thing. In Hasidic circles, it was always, particularly Chabad, it was always a thing. Obviously, for us, in Chabad, davening at the Rebbe's Kever is a very, very important thing, and so on and so forth. But what is this concept of davening at a Kever? And in fact, sorry? Yeah, and that's what I wanted to go into, because it's actually, it's an interesting thing what it is. And the reason I bring it up is because it actually, in many sources and in many literature, in many sort of bodies of literature, of halachic literature, is actually questioned and it's considered a very controversial thing. Because we need to understand first of all, what is it that you do when you daven at a kever tzaddik, and are you allowed to do that, and is it acceptable, and so on and so forth. So I'll go through a few different sources with you, which is very interesting. So the Bach is a famous Bach. The Bach brings us up. One of the problems of going to the... Let me just give you the background. One of the problems of going to grace of tzaddikim is because there's a pasuk in the Torah which says, there's a prohibition actually, that one is not allowed to be v'doyresh el hamesim. One is not allowed to communicate with the dead. It says in the Torah, clearly. Now, the exact wording of doyresh el hamesim is... Doresh means to seek out. And in its pure form, in its original form, was a form of witchcraft, actually. It's part of the prohibitions of witchcraft, where they used to actually have this thing where people would go to graves and they would like arouse the spirits of the dead and communicate with them and get answers from them and all kinds of things, right? And the Torah clearly prohibits it, but it's a more general thing where one's not supposed to communicate with the dead. So therefore, that's one of the questions that's brought up. So what's this business of going to daven at a kever of a tzaddik? What are you actually doing there, right? So the Bach, whose name is Rabbi Yoel Tzirkus, lived a few hundred years ago, was one of the great halachic commentaries on Shulchan Aruch. He brings from someone called Reb Chaim Paltiel, who lived in the time of the Tosfos, and got this going back like 1,000 years, right? And he says, this particular source says, that going to daven at graves could become a problem with Doresh El HaMeisim, it could become a problem with communicating with the dead. And he says, you find in the Chumash that Kolev went to daven at the gravesides of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. He says, it needs to be very clear. He didn't go to daven or to talk to them. He went to daven there because the kever of a tzaddik is a holy place. That's all. Right? Because he wanted to daven to Hashem, but he wanted to make sure that his davening should be accepted. So he chose a place which would have extra holiness, and a kever of a tzaddik is a place of extra holiness because the tzaddik is buried there, so it's got an extra amount of kedusha, and therefore it's more sort of opportune for our tefillahs, for our prayers to be accepted there. Right? But he says, this Reb Chaim Paltiel, he says, but the regular people that keep on doing this and they go, I don't know what they're doing there, they don't know what they're doing there, and a lot of times it could be a problem. That's what he says. Right? However, the Bach, who quotes this Reb Chaim Paltiel, he says, Umihu kvar herziku b'minag zeh. He says, but people have already held on to this custom. It's become a widespread custom for people to go to daven at gravesides, particularly gravesides of tzaddikim. And he implies that it's not just about davening at the place. There is some sort of communication that goes on with the tzaddik, and we need to understand what the meaning, understand what that is. And people go there to daven, particularly in times of trouble, in times of pain. They go there, and it's become a very set thing. And the Bach says, and perhaps, he says, we can justify the minhag, because they're relying on the Zohar. And he doesn't say which Zohar he's talking about. He says relying on the Zohar. So what Zohar is he talking about? So there's a Zohar in... The Zohar goes according to the Parshas of the Torah. So there's a Zohar in Parshas Achrimos that says the following. The Zohar says, Omar Rabbi Yisrael, Rabbi Yisrael is one of the rabbis of the Zohar. Right? He says, when the world needs rain... He says, why do they go to the dead people to daven? Why do they do that? Doesn't it say in the Torah, says the Zohar, v'doyra shel ha-meisim, that it's communicating to the dead? You know how to do that. Right? So he says two things. The Zohar says two things. He says, first of all, you've got to know who you're coming to. And second of all, what actually you're doing there and how you're coming there. He says the following. What are people going to? They're going to the Kavorim of a Tzaddik, Jewish graves, particularly, but more specifically, obviously, those people that live their lives according to the values of the Torah. So the Zohar says an interesting expression. He says, When the Torah says you're not allowed to go to graves to be doresh el amesim, to seek and communicate with the dead, he's talking about the people who are not righteous and the people who, even during their lifetimes, were compared to the dead. Because what does that mean? Based on the Gemara, of course, the Gemara says that Rashaim, wicked people, b'chayeyem kruyim mesim, in their lifetime they're called dead people. In other words, they don't have a proper life. They don't live their life with a life. Right? They live their lives according to values which are antithesis of life. But those people that live their lives according to the values of Torah and will try to be spiritual and so on and so forth, and particularly he says, and I'll tell you what he means by this expression, he says, particularly those people that made themselves dead when they were alive in a good sense. And the Zohar, the commentaries explain what it means is referring to the Gemara, that the Gemara says that you have to sacrifice yourself to be connected to Hashem, you have to sacrifice yourself to learn Torah, and it's based on a pasuk in Parshas Chukas, where it says, Adam ki yomus ba'oil, a person who dies in a tent. And the Gemara says what that means is that Torah only lasts by a person who's prepared to kill himself for it. In other words, it doesn't kill himself physically, but it means kill himself, means sacrifice, give up the pleasures of this world in order to attain something which is greater and higher. So those people, he says, that's fine. That they are not included in the prohibition of a doresh el hamesim, of coming to communicate with the dead, number one. And number two, says the Zohar, what are you actually coming to do? You are communicating with them, it's true. But what are you coming with? You're not coming to daven to them. That's one thing we need to understand. And that's very, very important. You never can daven to anything but Hashem. That is absolutely clear. Not a malach, not a tzaddik. Doesn't matter how great the tzaddik is. We don't daven to any power or anything outside of God. It's one of the 13 principles of faith, one of the Gimel Middos of the Rambam, right? So what are you doing then, he says? Is that when you come to these people, and number one, you're coming to the right people. In other words, it's not a matter of communicating with the dead, because these people are considered alive even when they're dead. Number one. Number two, he says, the second is, you're coming to ask them to daven to Hashem. That's what you're coming essentially to. And when you come properly, with humility, says the Rambam, says the Zohar. Not like the Torah is talking about, when he's talking about communicating with the dead, that people come with all sorts of witchcraft and all sorts of false beliefs, but when you come b'shviras halev, with a broken heart and with fasting and the intention that the neshama of that particular tzaddik should ask Hashem for mercy for you, that's perfectly acceptable. That's what the Zohar says. And the Maril, another great place, says a similar thing. He says, he says that same thing when you go, he says you should not. The Maril says actually you shouldn't actually talk to the tzaddik itself. You shouldn't even talk. You should just daven, and the intention is that they're davening with you, and you should just daven to Hashem. But we have to clarify that, because there's a sefer called Minor Loshem, and the Prima Godin brings us down another one of the great poskim. A sefer called Minor Loshem. Minor Loshem is a book of tefillahs, of prayers that you say at a grave. No, you don't daven. Well, what do you mean? No. So some people, they do. It depends what you're doing. Like in great tzaddikim, people actually daven regular davenings there. But besides the regular davenings, I mean, that's clear. When you daven a regular, like you go to Meiron and you daven the shachris there, right? That's just because you're davening shachris in the holy place. You're davening to Hashem, your regular morning prayer, but that's the holy place. But when you're davening specifically because you've come to the tzaddik's kever, so there is a book called Minor Lashon. A Minor Lashon is a collection of prayers you say at a grave, particularly at a grave of a tzaddik. And when you see it, you will see that there are different paragraphs there. If you know the translation, there are paragraphs where you're clearly davening straight to Hashem, but then there are paragraphs where you're clearly conversing with the tzaddik, right? Clearly, I mean, it's right. It starts off Shalom Aleichem, Adonai Numarein, whatever. It's like you, right? But if you look at the translation of the words, that's what the Prima Godim says. And in fact, this was written up in many, many places, because you know where it first began. For example, in Chabad we have a custom. Now we go to the Ohel, for example, we go to the Rebbe's resting place, we write a note, and we'll ask him for a blessing, as we would do when he was alive, right? Now, it's a particular Hasidic custom to do this kind of thing, but the truth is it's already been brought up by earlier Poskim, and it came up originally around the caver, around the grave of the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer was a great Hungarian sage a couple of hundred years ago, about 20 years ago, and there was this practice that people started to go to his grave, they started to put notes there. And this was brought up. What's this business of the paragraphs talking to the dead people or the dead? So the end of the whole story was that it doesn't matter. In other words, since we're talking about tzaddikim, And we're not davening to the tzaddik. This is the main point, right? We're not davening to the tzaddik at all. What we're doing is we're asking them to daven to Hashem for us, right? And we're asking them for a bracha. And these are tzaddikim who the Gemara says, that when they're dead, they're actually considered alive, because the life of a tzaddik is a different type of life. The life of a tzaddik, and this is what the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya, that the life of a tzaddik, even when he was alive, his life wasn't a physical life in the sense that we live a physical life. His whole life was a life of spirituality. So therefore, that life sort of perpetuates and continues on even afterwards. So just as we would give him a note when he was alive and ask him for a bracha, it's perfectly legitimate to do the same thing. As long as we understand what we're asking for. We're asking him to daven for us or intercede for us. That's one concept. And that's why it becomes perfectly okay. And that's the conclusion. That's why everyone accepts this idea today, and it's perfectly, perfectly in order. Particularly, as it's explained in a number of places, that there's another concept, another reason that we go and daven at a kever of a tzaddik. Like, what's the idea to get them to daven for us? Okay, so one of the ideas is they can daven better than we can, which is the idea of asking a tzaddik a bracha, because he's got better connections, he can daven better than we can. Every yid can daven, and we believe every davening is heard and can be answered. But a tzaddik has more power, of course, tzaddik's tefillah is better. But there's another dimension to this whole thing, and that is as follows. Based also on very early sources, and that is that sometimes part of the process of including a tzaddik in our trouble is a fascinating idea. Because it's written in many Kabbalistic sources that when Hashem decrees upon a person to suffer, let's say, for whatever reason, Hashem wants a certain person to go through a certain purification process or punishment or atonement, whatever the reason is, only Hashem knows, and why he gives us sometimes tests or challenges, right? But the idea of those challenges are that they can affect the person who deserves them, so to speak, or needs to get them, but they can't affect someone who doesn't deserve them, who's not supposed to get them, right? And part of the idea of davening at a kever of a tzaddik is part of the belief that we're all one body. So part of the idea that's written is when you go to a kever of a tzaddik and you pour out your heart and you say what you state what your needs are and you share with the tzaddik your challenges, so to speak, right? The idea is you include him in your pain. And therefore including him in your pain makes him daven. And when he davens, he's davening for himself, really. And that davening, that's another reason why that davening is a lot more chance to be heard, because he wasn't part of the decree. He's not supposed to get that pain. But because the tzaddik is so connected, and because davening at the kever of the tzaddik connects you to him, so to speak, so therefore your pain becomes his pain, and that's why his tefillah for that pain becomes so powerful. That's one of the ideas that's written in a number of places of why we daven at a tzaddik's kever.
And that, of course, is not considered communication
for the yid. No. So you are talking to him, but you're not davening to him. You're asking, you're sharing your situation with him, and you're asking him to daven for you.
What is communication with the
deity? Well, first of all, it's not communication. No, any communication. There's two issues. You see, let's just summarize this. What comes up in the Zohar is there could be two issues of going to a kever. One is communicating with the dead on any level. Another issue is davening to anything else but Hashem. So the communication with the dead, the Zohar says, is not a problem, because that's only talking about people who are wicked and are done in the context of that witchcraft and in that belief system of people that didn't live their lives according to the spiritual way. It doesn't include the tzaddikim. In other words, according to the Zohar, there's actually nothing wrong in going to a kever of a tzaddik and talking to him.
It doesn't include the tzaddik.
Right?
The person who's...
No. It doesn't include the... We're talking, yeah. It's who you're going to, that's the issue.
Okay.
Right? So that's number one. Number two, obviously you have to watch what you say to him. So talking to the tzaddik is not a problem, because the tzaddik is not included in the prohibition of communicating with the dead, according to the Zohar. And then it's an issue of what you're going to say to him. What you're going to say to him, obviously, it cannot be any form of prayer. But it can be sharing your pain. It can be asking for a bracha, as you would do when he was alive. And it can be simply asking him to daven for you, because his daven is more powerful than ours.
Is that Yiddish expression,
Zayn Agut Tebet? Exactly.
Is that what it is?
Often we say that.
Go to the cave and you say Zayn
Agut Tebet. We often say that by...
I would say
it
by mother's grave.
Yeah. No, it's a Yiddish expression. We often say it by you hear it often at the end of a eulogy. I think you'll say that, you know, you're sure that his neshama will be a Agut Tebet. What does that mean? That means his neshama will be a good interceder, if, if that's the right English. But a good, better means to ask. He'll be a good asker. Right? So we often wish that the person who passed away should be, should daven for his family. Because people daven for what's close to them. Even not such a big tzaddik, but they daven for what's close to them, and of course the person's family is close to them. That's what we often wish. We often give a bracha to the living people. We say, you know, the person who departs should be a good to better. But you're right, sometimes we daven that on the kaver also. We ask the person to be a good to better. Anyway, I just thought I'd bring it in because it's a lot of people write that the source of, at the end of the day, the source of going to a tzaddik's kever, is this week's parsha, the kol event of Amitz Yaakov. What needs to be developed is exactly what we do there. That's the issue. So it's just one issue is just davening there because it's a holy place, and that's clearly an issue. And then there's the issue of communication, of asking them for a bracha, which is a whole different issue. And that's okay, according to the Zohar, it comes and it's perfectly fine. Okay. Good. Let's go back to the parsha now. Now, we've got a couple of problems with the parsha. First of all, there's a famous contradiction between the Rashi we just learned and another Rashi. Let's go back to the second Rashi on the page. This was relearned. First of all, Rashi says, Kulam Anoshim, they were all men of stature, meaning, Kol Anoshim Shubu Mikra. Said Rashi, all time says Anoshim in the Pasuk, Lashon Chashivus, it's an expression of prominence. Voice of Shok, Sherim, at that time they were kosher. That's one Rashi. The problem is, it doesn't fit with another Rashi. Rashi later on, it says, when they came back, it says, Vayelchu Vayovoyu. They went to Eretz Yisrael and they came back from Eretz Yisrael. Now, what's bothering Rashi, of course, is why does the Pasuk put Vayelchu Vayavoyu together? They went and they came back. They went before, they came back 40 days later. Why is it all together all of a sudden? Says Rashi, Mahu Vayelchu, what does it mean they went and they came back? Lehakish Halichoson Libiosom. It's to compare their going to their coming. Meaning, Ma the Osan Be'etzero, just like when they came back, they clearly came back with an evil plan to dissuade the Yidden from going to Eretz Yisrael and to give a negative report, weakening their faith and their amunah in the whole process. Af Halichasan Be'etzero, so too, going was a bad plan. In other words, they went, their intentions going was faulty. Okay? So I don't think it all of a sudden had a change of heart. They went problematic. That's why they came back problematic. Which of course is a direct contradiction to the previous Rashi. Previous Rashi says that when they went, they were kosher, they were kosher, they were tzaddikim. And this Rashi says that they went like they came back like they came. Sorry, they came back like they went. Meaning, just as they came back with an evil plan, they went with an evil plan. So how do those two things fit together?
Rev, I can't understand two Rashis. I think the one Rashi.
Exactly, it's one Rashi. There's two. He's contradicting himself. Correct.
Oh, he's contradicting
himself. Yeah. That's my question.
Okay.
The question is the two.
There were two Rashi.
No. Sorry. I wasn't clear. When I say two Rashi, I mean two passages in Rashi.
Okay.
Which seem to be contradictory. He seems to be contradicting himself.
Okay. I understand.
The other thing, of course, is the famous Rashi, which I put at the end of the handout, at the very first pasuk of the parasha, where Rashi says Shlach Lecha. Hashem says Shlach Lecha. Send for yourself. You like, and Rashi says, Ledatcha. Send like according to your plan, like you need to send. Ani eini mitzavah lecha. I'm not commanding you. Im tirtzeh shlach, if you want, go send. Right? Which is almost a bizarre thing. So what am I supposed to do it? I mean, if Hashem wasn't that happy, what, he bowed to pressure? All of a sudden, he's a modern day politician because the people want, so he's bowing to pressure. If Hashem didn't want, Hashem didn't want. So what do you mean? Shlach, what does this Rashi mean? Right? I mean, it's a famous Rashi, but what it actually doesn't mean. How could Moshe send it if it was clear Hashem didn't want? He said, you send, you know, do it because the people have asked you, so you think it's a good idea, so go ahead and do it. I don't think it's a good idea, you said. What does that mean? I think I shared with you before the famous Kliyokra. I love this Kliyokra. It says, Shlach Lecha Anoshim. Like send, Hashem wasn't worried about the sending a spy. Sending a spy is a good idea. So what was the part that Moshe, do it like you want to do it, like instead of what I want to do? He says, it says, Shlach Lecha Anashim, send for yourself men. The Kliyokra says, Hashem says, you think you should send men. If you ask me, I think you should send women. Because, that's what the Kliyokra says. That's a Kliyokra. It didn't make sense. He says, why? Because if the women would have went, they would have never said anything negative about Eretz Yisrael. The whole problem with the Shadrach is because it was men, not women. The women didn't sin in the golden calf. The women wouldn't have sinned with this either. It's the men that made the problem. That's what the Kliyaka says. Interesting. Okay, but we're talking about Rashi now. So what does Rashi mean? Like, so there's a different perspective. I'm going to show you a few different thoughts. And the first thought is a very fascinating idea that comes from one of the Hasidic masters called Mo'er V'Shomesh. Mo'er V'Shomesh's name was Rabbi Kloinemus Kalman Halevi Epstein. I looked it up yesterday. Mo'er V'Shomesh is very famous, but I was wondering who it was. He was a Talmud, he was a disciple of the Noam Elimelech, the Melech Rizensk, who was a disciple of the Mezritcha Magid, which was very, very much the beginning of the Hasidic movement. The Baal Shem Tov, the successor of the Baal Shem Tov was the Magid of Mezritch. And the Magid of Mezritch had many, many disciples. From a few of them were the ones that from them branched out all the Hasidic movements. One of them was the Rebbe Elimelech Malijensk, who many of the Hasidic dynasties today all trace themselves back to his disciples, or whatever the case is. Anyway, the Mo'er V'Shomesh is a very classic Hasidic commentary on a bit Kabbalistic, a bit esoteric, on the Chumash, and he gives a very interesting perspective. And the perspective is as follows. He quotes an Arizal. You know, we call the spies the Meraglim, right? The spies. Where do we find the word Meraglim first in the Chumash? Anyone from Monday morning? Right, first we find the language Meraglim by Yosef. Yosef turned around to his brothers when they came to Egypt, and he said, "Meraglim atem, you are Meraglim." Right. So the Arizal makes an incredible connection between Yosef calling his brothers Meraglim and the Meraglim. And he said, and the Mo'er V'Shomesh explains the following idea. He says, there's a concept in Kabbalah. This is very Kabbalistic and very cryptic and esoteric. There's a concept in Kabbalah called Ibur Hanashomis. Ibur Hanashomis means the, I don't even know how you translate it. It's Ibur only means pregnancy, but it means the implanting of an neshama into someone else. In other words, sometimes what can happen is a person can have a neshama, a person can have a soul, and he can then absorb part of or a whole other soul, another soul, that can become part of his being for whatever purpose. And that process is called Ibur HaNeshamas.
Okay? While alive.
Yeah, while he's alive, yeah. Now, sometimes what happens is like this, that a person has a mission. It's a very spooky idea, this. A person has a mission. What's that?
And
there is
one complete mission.
No. Excuse me. No, it doesn't give an extra mission. No. No, that's enough. One mission is enough. It says like this. Sometimes what happens is a person has a mission, but he's also been given, for whatever reason, a Yetzirah, an evil inclination. And therefore he has a great challenge and a great temptation. And that temptation actually makes it very difficult for him to fulfill his mission. So the guy is struggling to fulfill his mission, in other words, to listen to his neshama and to be in line with what his neshama wants him to do, because he's overrun with this incredible challenge coming from the Yetzer Hara, and a person wants to do the right thing, but he's totally struggling. So sometimes what can happen, and this is like a very Hasidic concept, and this is the whole idea of a tzaddik and be connected to a tzaddik and so on. Sometimes the tzaddik, who this person is connected to, will give the person spiritual help. Right? And that's one of the ideas of being connected to a tzaddik, when you get extra spiritual boost from the tzaddik who you're connected to, right? How does the tzaddik give the help? Sometimes the tzaddik will give the help by the tzaddik will draw down, which the tzaddik can do because of his level. A tzaddik will draw down a neshama from a different tzaddik, from someone that's whatever, it's passed on or whatever the case is, and infuse the person with a neshama from the other tzaddik. So now the person has an extra boost of neshama to help him along with his mission. And he's very quick to clarify and explain that it doesn't mean, of course, that the person's free will has been taken away. That never happens. Right? A person always has a free will. It just means he's got some extra inspiration, extra boost with which he can now use as a support and a help to overcome his yetzer hara. Free choice will always exist. He'll always have the choice to choose between right and wrong, between good and evil. But at least now he's got more koyach to be able to do that. Says the Maariv Shamash like this. These Meraglim, they were problematic people. Now the Gemara even says it, because the Gemara goes through the names of the Meraglim and says, even hinted in their names, that they had tremendous yetzaharas. They had tremendous evil inclinations, these people. And when they were sent, they happened to be in management, they happened to be the people that Hashem had appointed for this mission, but they were set up in a mission which was very problematic to begin with. Because, like the one Rashi says, right, that they went the way they came. In other words, when they went, they were problematic already. They had this tremendous negativity and this tremendous temptation which was going to ruin their mission if they're not careful. That's a good question. Why they said, I don't know. That's needs to be understood. Okay. So what was the plan? The plan was that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to give them some assistance, and he was going to do the system of Ibruha Neshamas. Whose Neshamas were they going to get? They were going to get the Neshamas of the 12 tribes, of the 12 brothers, right? Which is why Yosef told them when they came to Mitzrayim, Meraglim Atem. I want to just inform you, you are going to be the Meraglim. Not the Meraglim, not the spies in Egypt. You are going to be the Meraglim. Because what you're going to have to do, and when the Meraglim are eventually sent, your Neshamas, including himself, is going to have to be superimposed, so to speak, in the Neshamas of Meraglim. And that's the Arizal's Kabbalistic interpretation of what Yosef said to the Shvatim in the very, very beginning, Meraglim Atem. So each one went with his shevet. Each one went with his tribe. So when they went to Eretz Yisrael, they didn't go alone. They went with the neshama of their shevet. They went with their challenge, their personality challenge, but went with the power of the shevet. They went with the power of the neshama, right? Which explains the contradiction between the two Rashis. The one Rashi says that they went like they came and they had an evil plan going there, an evil plan going back. That's them themselves. But when Rashi says, Kulam Oysashah, at that time they were kosher, they weren't kosher when they came back, but they were kosher when they went, is a reference to the neshama of the Shevet, of the Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, that they had when they went. That's what made them kosher when they went. So both things are true. The two Rashis are true, and it's not a contradiction at all. The problem is that the tribe of Levi wasn't in this equation because he didn't go. Tribe of Levi didn't go to this, right? You realize there were 12 tribes that went, but not Levi. Why were there 12 tribes? Because one of the tribes we know is split into two, right? Which one? Yosef split into two. So Yosef became a Nashav Ephraim, right? Now Yosef's neshama could only go to one of them. Each one got one neshama. So Yehuda went to Kole, because his neshama went to the spy of Yehuda. The neshama of Zvulun went to the spy of Zvulun. Whose neshama was Yosef going to go to? So it was given to the spy of Manasseh. Why? Why not to the spy of Ephraim? Because the spy of Ephraim was Yeshua. Yeshua was already a tzaddik. He didn't need it so much. He didn't need that special assistance so much. Right? The others did. He was a tzaddik to begin with. So therefore, the neshama of Yosef went to Ephraim. Went to Manasseh, I mean. Right? So the only one that was left without a neshama was Yeshua. Now, he didn't get one because he was a tzaddik, but still he was going to dangerous territory. He was going to go with a whole bunch of chevra that are challenging. So he gets the special bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu. Why did he get the special bracha from Moshe Rabbeinu? Because he didn't have an neshama for tzaddik. So it explains why Moshe Rabbeinu singled him out to give him a bracha. Kolei was the other one that survived. He didn't need a special bracha because he had the neshama of Yehuda. And for him it worked. But how did it work? They were all very difficult situations. They were in a very difficult, challenging situation. Particularly when the one who wanted to survive, which was Kolev, also had the inner challenge, but he had the neshama of Yehuda, which he did want to access and he did want to use, and he didn't want to be influenced by his peers, so he went to Hebron to daven just for that extra boost again, that he should be able to use the neshama of Yehuda, and he did, and he came back and he was fine. So at the end of the day, Yeshua and Kolev were fine. Right? So that explains all the things. So what happened in Eretz Yisrael when they came back? The Meraglim had then chosen, because the free choice not taken away, they had chosen not to use the support of the Neshamas and the Shvatim they were given, and they chose to come back and report negatively. Once they made that choice, the Neshamas and the Shvatim left them. So when they came back without those Neshamas. which explains what Rashi says, that they were tzaddikim then, and they weren't tzaddikim when they came back. That was as far as the neshama was concerned. But as far as their own personality was concerned, they were the same going and the same coming. But they were different in terms of the neshama of the shevet, going and coming, and that's the Kabbalistic interpretation of the Mor v'Shamash. That's one idea. The other idea is, now let's go back to this pasuk of Shlach Lecha. And I want to just give you an interesting interpretation from the Chassam Sofer. We mentioned it before. Chassam Sofer has a fascinating interpretation. It's fascinating because it goes to a very, very fundamental concept. And it's got a lot to do with leadership. It's an interesting concept. You know, leadership is a very, very complicated area in life, right? How to be a good leader, how not to fail as a leader. But one of the things also that we learn about leadership is that leaders are sometimes as good as the people that send them. In other words, it goes both ways. A good leader leads and improves the flock. But also a good leader is one that the people who sent him or appointed him to lead want him to lead. And we find that concept many times in different sources where leaders depend a lot on the people that send them. Even with Moshe Rabbeinu we find that. Moshe Rabbeinu, the level of spirituality dropped when the Yidden sinned. Because they weren't at such a high level, their leader weren't at such a high level. So the two, the leader and the following of the leader, are very intertwined. So he says like this. He says, this mission of Sam Sofer says, he says like, it's any time you have a shliach tzibur, like a chazan is the same thing. The chazan's tefillahs have a lot to do with the people that send him. Right? Because a chazan is also like a leader who leads the tefillahs, and he's... So on the one hand, he's supposed to send someone, like Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur says in Shulchan Aruch, particularly he's supposed to send someone that is pious, that is fit to be a leader, is fit to carry the davening of the people. On the other hand, however, a chazan is only, his tefillah is only as good as the people that send it. So it depends a lot on how they send him and so on and so forth. I mean, it's a long concept, but just that's the idea. Says Chassam Sofer a concept like this. He says, what happened with the Meraglim is as follows. Moshe Rabbeinu thought it was a good idea to send Meraglim. And in fact, it was a good idea to send Meraglim. There's nothing wrong with sending Meraglim. There's nothing wrong in sending people to check out the land, to investigate, to develop strategy of how we're supposed to conquer this land. Hashem has given us this land. Let's figure out how to do it now. Right? Nothing wrong with that. That was Moshe Rabbeinu's idea. The problem is, we read later on in Chumash, in fact, it's not even in this parsha, later on in Dvarim, where Moshe Rabbeinu is recounting the story of the Meraglim and is reminding the Jewish people of how they messed up. He says to them, "Vatikrevun elai kulchem. You all came to me in a big rush and thing, and you pressured me to send spies. And we sent spies and I landed up a mess." And that's not mentioned here. We don't even know. Really, if you just read this parasha, you wouldn't even know whose idea it was. In fact, it comes out more as Moshe Rabbeinu's idea, because Hashem says, "Shlach Lecha," like your idea. We don't know. We know because we know from later on in the Chumash, but we don't know that it was actually the Jewish people's idea. So was it Hashem's idea? Was it Moshe Rabbeinu's idea? Was it the Jewish people's idea? Whose idea was it? Says Chassam Sofer like this: there were two different ideas. There were two different ideas. Moshe Rabbeinu had an idea to send Meraglim, right? And what happened was, at the same time that Moshe Rabbeinu was going to send the Meraglim, the Jewish people thought of it also, but they thought of it for a different reason. They thought of it for a negative reason. They were worried. They didn't believe in Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu had absolute faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we can conquer the land of Israel. Just a matter of developing strategy. The Yidden weren't so sure. Their faith was weakened. So Hashem comes to Moshe Rabbeinu and he says, "Shlach Lecha Hashem. You send it. You send because it's your idea. Because if you send it because it's your idea, it's going to work. Because the messenger is as good as the one who sends it." The problem at the last minute, says the Chassam Sofer, what happened is that it became everyone's idea. The Yidden all of a sudden popped out, they want Meraglim, independent of Moshe Rabbeinu. And when they went, they ended up being not only the messengers of Moshe Rabbeinu, they weren't only the Shliach Tzibur, the Chazan of Moshe Rabbeinu, they were the Shliach Tzibur of everyone. And because of the Shliach Tzibur of everyone, that's why it got messed up. Because they had bad intentions, the people that sent it. Hashem was hinting that to Moshe Rabbeinu. He's saying, "Shlach Lecha, send it because you think it's a good idea. Then it'll work, but not if everyone else thinks it's a good idea." However, all that still doesn't explain the one phrase in Rashi where Rashi says, I'm not commanding you to do this. In other words, it's your idea, I'm not even going to command you to do that. So just to end off and to explain that part, I'll just share with you a concept that the Rebbe explains in this parsha, based on the following comment. He says the following. He says that the parsha's name is Shlach Lecha, right? The first part of the parsha is the story of the Meraglim. And this is consistent with the view that he has in interpreting all the parshas. And that is like this, that the name of the parsha always represents the essence of the parsha. Now he says an interesting thing. The name of the parsha, Shlach, is about the story of the Meraglim, correct? But the rest, that's just the story. The rest of the parsha is more mitzvahs. In fact, some very fundamental mitzvahs. Mitzvahs of karbonis, sacrifices. Mitzvahs that have to do with idol worship, which is very, very central to the Jewish people. The mitzvah of tzitzis, which is there to remind us about all the mitzvahs. So it seems of a parsha where you've got a lot of fundamental things, and yet the name of the parsha is more referenced in the story of the Meraglim, which seems less fundamental than all the mitzvahs in the parsha. So why? What's the lesson? So he says, no. He says, actually, the reason that the beginning of the parsha is the story of Shlach Lecha is because the beginning of the parsha gives us certain messages which create a formula of how we serve Hashem. And he says this idea. He says, every mitzvah is like going into Eretz Yisrael. That's why our whole service of Hashem is hinted in the story. How so? What was the idea of the Jewish people going to Eretz Yisrael? What was the idea behind that? The idea was, as we know, that they were to leave the spiritual, we've talked about this many times, they were to leave the spirituality of the desert and go into a land that was physical, where they would live a very physical life and bring godliness into the physical. Every time we do a mitzvah, it's the same concept. Right? Every time we pick up a mash, light Shabbos candles, that's the idea. We're bringing spirituality into the physical. Every time we give tzedakah, every time we keep Shabbos, every time we eat kosher, have a mezuzah, tefillin, whatever, it's all the same idea. So every mitzvah is in fact this idea of going into Eretz Yisrael. So he says, there are three things we have to know when we go into Eretz Yisrael, when we go do a mitzvah, and they come out of this story. The first is analyzing the mistake of the Meraglim. What's the mistake of the Meraglim? So he says a famous idea, we alluded to it before. The mistake of the Meraglim was that not that they went to spy out the land. That's not the problem. They were sent to do that. They were asked to do that. The problem with them was they gave etzes. They started giving advice, saying interpretation. In other words, like this. They were given a mission. We are going to conquer Eretz Yisrael. Right? The question was, how? Your job is to find out how. And they turned it from the how, they turned it into an if. Or a why. That's completely flawed. That's when the trouble starts. I'll just tell you an interesting thing, just because it just came up now. A few days ago, one of the secretaries of the Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away, Rabbi Klein, a very, very special man. I think he's the first one of the secretaries. It's quite a sad thing. So they're putting up online different things of him, an historian, and so they put out, and I never saw it before, a sort of little video of him talking to, after Gimel Tammuz, after the Yahrzeit of the Rebbe, and he was asked to speak, I think it was to a group of Bochrim, or who hadn't seen the Rebbe, and he was like answering questions of how it was to be secretary of the Rebbe, and he didn't say much. He was always known as a very trusted secretary, and he didn't divulge anything, he's not divulged, but things that he could, I suppose, he did. So people sent, after he talked, people sent up questions. So he's reading the questions from the note. One of the questions was, it was an interesting question, one of the Brachim asked, it says, do you know why, after the Rebbe's wife passed away, and the Rebbe essentially didn't live in his house, he lived for the first year, but he moved into his office room, he moved into 770, he didn't go home much afterwards at all. But nevertheless, when it came sukkahs, he instructed they should still build a sukkah at the house. So they asked him, well, it was interesting, they asked him, maybe he'll know, because the secretary was close. Does he know why the Rebbe still instructed they should build a sukkah in President Street, where the Rebbe's house was, even though he wasn't there for sukkahs, he was in 770, and there was a sukkah for him there. So he's reading the question, he says, I want to just say, he says, that, I don't know who wrote this question, but I want to educate you, he says, and this question is an inappropriate question. He says, because one thing I will tell you about all my years, and he was the Rebbe secretary for like 30 years, all my years that we worked not only me, he says, all of us, he says, all the years we worked as the Rebbe secretary, we never asked the question why. There was no such thing. The Rebbe said to do something, we did it, finished. I mean, why? Why? He says, do it. It means it needs to be done. It can be done. And we got it done. We never ever asked the question, why is he asking me? I should know why. How am I supposed to know any more than you? That was his point. But obviously we have to, the question why is a legitimate question when, after we've done it. It's like an asim and nishpa concept. In other words, after we committed to doing it, yes, part of Yiddishkeit is investigating things to understand the mitzvahs. That's a separate issue. But why I need to do something, you need to do it because Hashem said so. Right? And in terms of tzaddikim, I guess there was the same sort of commitment where I serve you and I do what you tell me to do, right? They came back with an if, you understand? So the Rebbe says the same thing. When we give in mitzvahs, our fundamental belief has to be that everything Hashem tells us to do, we can do. If Hashem tells us to do a mitzvah, it can be very hard to do. It's part of our mission of going into Eretz Yisrael, we can do it. It's conquering the physical world to bring godliness into it, it can be done. The question is how? Okay, how's the story? Go figure out how. But if Hashem said you can do it, you can do it. That's the first lesson we learn from this Meraglim. That's what's a fundamental lesson. The second he says is the concept of Meraglim. That it is important to investigate. You can't just land in Eretz Yisrael. You have to tour the land first. You have to investigate the land. He says, what's the idea behind that? It's the idea of preparing for a mitzvah. It's the idea of making a bracha before a mitzvah. Doing a mitzvah is like going to the land of Eretz Yisrael, but you can't just land there. You've got to prepare for it. You've got to investigate it. You've got to know what you're doing. Not why you're doing it, but where, what you're doing. Understand what it is that you're doing. Build a relationship with the mitzvah so it becomes yours before you do it. Send meraglim. Just like the meraglim went to Israel, before we do a mitzvah, we have to send meraglim too. We have to make a bracha. We have to think about the mitzvah. We have to investigate the mitzvah. We have to research the mitzvah. It's part of building a relationship with the mitzvah and then going into the mitzvah. And the third lesson is the shlach lecha. What's the shlach lecha? Ultimately, the ideal of serving Hashem is that it needs to become our thing. Not something that we commanded to do, but something that we do. Hashem says, shlach lecha. Obviously we do it because it's Hashem's command. But we have to become so one with Torah and mitzvahs. Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, there needs to become something that's yours. It needs to be something that you own, that you absorb, that it's like you want to do it. You're not doing it because I'm telling you to do it, because you want to do it. When can that happen? Only when it becomes so one with it, when it becomes so immersed in it, and it becomes your thing, then it's lecha. So that word, shlach lecha ledaitcha, when Hashem says, send for you because you commanding it, you doing it, and Hashem says, I'm not commanding you, it doesn't mean, it's not. The intention is, you do it, I'm not commanding you, that means I don't want it to be done, but you, no, that's not the idea. The idea is, I'm not commanding you, in other words, what's the ideal for how you should do it? When you do it because you're doing it, and not because I'm commanding you to do it. That's what Rashi means. And that's the third lesson. And that's why the story of the Raglim is such an important formula to how we serve Hashem, because we need to have those three things: believing it can be done, investigating, researching it so we build a relationship with it, and then making it ours so that it's lecha, it's actually our thing. Okay.